You see what's happened to coal companies' stock prices. You see major banks like Bank of America withdrawing from coal. And so to, you know, my friends in the coal sector and those support of coal, I say, you know, we've got to move on beyond where we believe or not.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Earth is getting warmer. NASA says temperatures will go up by 2 to 6 degrees Celsius within the next century due to climate change. Now, energy production has long been an important topic in Wyoming, but it's increasingly becoming an important global conversation, especially in the context of climate change. Wyoming, as the second largest energy-producing state in the U.S., is central to that conversation. Decisions made today will likely affect the state and the country for years and decades to come. In an interview with Wyoming Public Radio's energy reporter, Stephanie Joyce, Governor Matt Mead started by saying he thinks it's time to move past the debate about climate change.
I think regardless of the energy source, we should always be looking at ways how to improve it. Even the, you know, green energy, for example, wind energy, has its own challenges with viewshed, with endangered species. The same is true with fossil fuels. We should all have a goal to how do we make every energy source as clean, as efficient, and as environmentally friendly as we can. Let's find technology and innovation that finds the solutions. It's not a solution to take coal off the table. It's too good of an energy source, so let's look to how do we improve it. While I may be a skeptic, we do see that the markets are not a skeptic. You see what's happened to coal companies' stock prices. You see major banks like Bank of America withdrawing from coal. And so to, you know, my friends in the coal sector and those support of coal, I say, you know, we've got to move on beyond where we believe or not. And here's the reality. Other industries believe it. Other countries believe it. And so we are now in a position, let's find the solutions for it.
We've all heard at this point about the Obama administration's new carbon regulations for power plants. Those primarily target coal-fired power plants and making sure that those power plants do get cleaner, that we do capture the emissions or reduce the emissions from those coal-fired power plants over the next 15 years and improve the technology or shut them down if that's not possible. So I guess, what's your plan with regard to those regulations here in Wyoming?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think the regulations are horrible. And the reason I think it's horrible is because I don't think it does much in the way of providing for innovation and technology. What it does do a lot is try to shut these coal-fired plants down. And it's particularly harmful to the state of Wyoming. You know, when the draft rule came out, we commented on it, and the draft rule required 19% reduction for Wyoming. And we made serious comments, as did some of the state agencies. And then the final rule comes out, and it's gone from 19% to 41%. So my comments netted about 20% additional burden on the state of Wyoming. But beyond that, I think it's a bad deal because I do think it effectively starts taking coal off the table. And that's not just bad for Wyoming. It's frankly bad for the country. And no one's asking the question, assume they get everything they want in this. What does it do? What does it do to the United States in terms of the economy, in terms of us not being as competitive as we should be? And what does it do supposedly on the pro side? What does it do in terms of this goal of helping the environment? And I think it's negligible at best.
In the past, regulations have come down. People have said it's going to ruin this industry. It's going to ruin that industry. And industries have actually innovated and have managed to comply typically in the past. Why would this regulation be any different? It set a limit, it set a target. Why wouldn't the coal industry be able to innovate its way to that goal?
We're in a situation where these rules are not in isolation. You put the clean air rules on top of the regional haze rules, on top of the mercury rules. And this is different than what we've seen in the past. It is a layering, and also, in order for us, you know, to say, well, we'll get through this, you have to say the industry is going to survive. Because innovation and technology are not going to come in a vacuum where you have a dying industry. I mean, who's going to invest in the technology needed to do that? You know, we didn't move from the candle to the light bulb because of regulations. We did it because we had a spirit of innovation and opportunity for technology in this country. And I think the same is true with coal. Create an environment where it is not death by regulations, but it is improvement by innovation. And I'm convinced science and scientists can find the answers to coal.
But even when coal companies were doing well, even when they were raking in huge profits, I think a lot of people have argued that they didn't prioritize those investments in research and development. They didn't prioritize innovation and working with their customers, the utilities, to come up with solutions. So what makes you think that that would change in the future?
Depending upon the company, depending how far you go back, I mean, that may be a legit criticism that you had an opportunity to do that. But if you look at, you know, the way regulation works in this country now, you have to take that criticism in context. Say you're in that business and you invest $100 million or $1 billion on new technology and it gets you to point A, then what happens is just what's happening now. They invested a lot of money in improving coal-fired plants, and then new regulations come along. And so we have not created an environment where there's an incentive to be proactive, because if you're proactive, there's no reward in it. There's just the punishment for, oh, you've gone here, now we're going to add regulations just to show you what you really should have done.
You've said that you are planning to sue over these new regulations. Are you planning on drafting a compliance plan?
We've been looking at that as everyone else has, and it's sort of under this threat that either you come up with a state plan or you're going to have to live under a federal plan. And we've done that deal. That is exactly what happened with regional haze. We worked and worked and worked and came up with a plan, a state plan for regional haze that we thought was very good. EPA comes in and says it's not to their liking, and so you're under a federal plan anyway, or that's what they're attempting to do. We're in litigation about that right now. And so, yeah, we don't live in a vacuum. We look at it and say, you know, if this comes about, whether we're forced to do a state plan or a federal plan, you know, how would we go about doing it? And, you know, when it was a 19% reduction, looked onerous, and then, as I said, we commented to the EPA and they bumped us up to 41%, and it looks much worse now.
So is that a yes or no on the compliance plan?
Well, yeah, well, it's a yes. I mean, we've been looking on how to work it, but, you know, to date, I will tell you that I don't see, and I don't think the people in my state agency see, a real workable plan on how to go forward to get this accomplished.
Wyoming has excellent renewable energy resources, both wind and solar. And I think a lot of people would argue they're underutilized at the moment. There isn't nearly as much investment in wind here as there is in places like Iowa and Texas. What role should renewable resources play here in Wyoming going forward?
As like I said, I think this is the time to be adding energy sources. And I think renewables need to play a bigger and bigger role. You know, proudly say we have the best onshore wind in the country. We have some great opportunities to do that. But wind, like other energy sources, has its own challenges. If you're in an area where you're going to be looking at oil derrick for 6 months versus wind turbines for 30 years, people have different feelings on that. If you have concerns, as say the Audubon Society does, about the wind turbines and raptors, if you have concerns about bats, those are all challenges. And then the other part of it with regard to wind is then you get into the issue of transmission and, you know, where are you going to put the power lines and whose backyard do the power lines go through? So it has its own challenges, but as you see, as a company in the planning process in Wyoming to put up the world's largest wind farm. And so it's certainly not a situation Wyoming has stifled wind development. It's that we have to work through a different set of issues, but also tricky issues to get those things done as well.
You're revising your energy strategy at the moment. I was up at the energy strategy meeting in Gillette where you were soliciting input from the public. One of the things that a number of people told me was they're very happy that you're asking for their input, but what they'd really like is to hear what your plan is. So if you had to summarize for those people who are wondering, what's your plan?
Well, part of the energy strategy is to help develop that plan, and that's why we reach out to people on what their point of view is. But I would say this is, you know, Before I came into office, the state that exports more energy than any other state didn't have an energy plan. And so part of the energy plan is to see what we have, where we are, and where we're going. I think that the energy strategy, I guess, overall is I want to make sure we have a way to responsibly develop our minerals in an environmentally sound way, that we can do so and not only meet what other states are doing, but frankly set the example for the country on how to go about doing this, so that, you know, 10 years, 50 years from now, we can say, listen, we have the number one uranium reserves, number one in coal, you know, top 10 in oil and gas, that we've continued to develop those. We have protected our environment. We have found the right balance, and that we've provided the wealth to the citizens of this state that resulted from that development, that builds our schools, builds our roads, funds our family services, funds our Department of Health, and that we do it in a way that, you know, 50 years from now, we still love the look, the feel, the taste of Wyoming.
That was Governor Matt Mead speaking with Stephanie Joyce. Pope Francis' 2015 encyclical on the environment received a thorough reading here in Wyoming. The letter represents a moral framework for approaching issues like climate change. As Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank reports, it's a difficult subject for Catholics in the Cowboy State.
Tonight's class on the new papal encyclical at St. Paul's Newman Catholic Church in Laramie begins, well, in the beginning. Before parishioners dive into the Pope's message, they read aloud from Genesis.
And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day.
The letter began drawing a flurry of praise and condemnation even before it was officially published. The teacher here, Father Rob Spalding, points out that a draft was leaked to the press a few days early.
So clearly it was something that there was great interest about.
The encyclical outlines the idea of integral ecology, that care for the natural world and justice for society's most vulnerable are interconnected. Despite the fanfare, Spalding tells his class that this is hardly the first time the church has weighed in on the environment.
Francis quotes John Paul II over 35 times, Benedict XVI 27, bishops' conferences from around the world.
Francis does acknowledge the scientific consensus on man-made climate change and calls for policies to curb carbon dioxide emissions. But Spalding says that's just one piece of something much bigger.
It's through the lens of climate, but the implications of being a common humanity sharing a common home, really that's the springboard for the theology that's contained here, not just whether you might believe in climate change or humanity's contribution to it.
But passages like those that name coal as a prime climate change culprit will draw the most scrutiny here in Wyoming, says Tom Quinlivan, a Laramie Catholic who's taking the class.
I think it can be a harder truth to swallow just because so many people depend on it. You know, we have so many mining families. They wouldn't be here without the mining industries. And so, yeah, I think it is a little bit tough here in this state.
Maybe we could recite this canticle. Encyclicals present new Catholic social teaching, but they also leave some room for the faithful to disagree. And here in Wyoming, where just 42% of residents say they believe humans cause climate change, many have.
The issue that concerns me is when the Holy Father calls into question the motivation of business owners.
Kevin Roberts is president of Wyoming Catholic College in Lander. He says environmentalists are exploiting the Pope's words to push an agenda that hurts Wyoming. That's as state leaders fight President Obama's Clean Power Plan, which would require the state to cut its carbon emissions by more than 40% over the next 15 years.
The best, or for that matter, grossest example of this encyclical being hijacked is by President Obama himself, who has unjustly and with just a terrible policy that's an abomination made it impossible for coal companies in Wyoming to produce.
The hum of coal trains is constant in Guernsey. Agnes Hauschar has lived here for more than 70 years. Between the trains and the coal-fired power plant, she says coal is a big deal here.
We've got the power plant to the south. A lot of people in this area work there or work, well, for the railroad. So it's something to worry about.
Wyoming produces 40% of the nation's coal. The industry accounts for 6% of the state's total jobs. Hauschar and her family are longtime members of Guernsey's small Catholic parish. She says she recently got into an argument about the Pope with her sons.
They said the Pope should stay out of politics. They consider this very political. I think the Pope has to preach the gospel.
But Hauschar knows that message could have an impact on Wyoming coal.
So I'm kind of personally torn because what the Pope says is very true. At the same time, I have to look around me and see people here who will be hurting.
The most skeptical, I think, tends to be fearful that Pope Francis has been influenced by governmental, societal powers.
Father Andrew Duncan is the priest in Guernsey. He says he's grateful for the encyclical, but he's in no hurry to preach climate change from the pulpit.
I feel I'm in a difficult position because I agree with the criticisms that I think he brings in this encyclical, but I also feel that my bread and butter is the people here.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
The debate about whether or not humans are warming the planet is essentially over. 97% of climate scientists agree that we are. But as Amy Martin reports, the debate over tactics about how to reduce our carbon emissions is only starting to heat up.
The 2014 People's Climate March in New York City was a watershed moment for climate change activists.
The people are rising! No more compromises!
Over 300,000 people attended the march, and hundreds of small local groups suddenly saw their work as part of a broad social movement. The momentum continued to build as climate groups successfully lobbied to shut down the Keystone XL pipeline and helped push the federal government to place a moratorium on new coal leases. In the next 2 weeks, grassroots activists will be rallying again with a series of protests around the world aimed at convincing governments and industry to limit fossil fuel development.
We have to keep almost all the oil and gas and coal that we know about underground. It's the only place that's safe.
Bill McKibben is the co-founder of 350.org, an international climate activist group. He maintains the slogan, "Keep it in the ground," shouldn't be political.
The thing of it is that it's not like a great ideological contest, or at least it shouldn't be. It really is just math.
That math looks like this. If fossil fuel industries develop all their known resources worldwide, 3 times more carbon will be released into the air than the atmosphere can handle. Those numbers come from a study in the journal Nature and from a climate change think tank called Carbon Tracker. So what does emitting the carbon from all those known resources actually mean, according to McKibben?
If you follow their stated business plan, the planet tanks.
That's why McKibben and others are demanding that those business plans change. But even among people who agree with that goal, there's controversy about how to make it happen. Economist Lucas Davis researches energy and environmental markets at UC Berkeley. He doesn't see the need for all the marching and the chanting. Instead, he believes there's a more efficient choice.
I feel like we could just get together and pass a carbon tax.
Davis is concerned that the current tactics of the climate change movement divert attention away from something more effective and realistic, putting a price on carbon. Rather than pushing governments and industry to limit fossil fuel supply, Davis says we should just decrease demand by making fossil fuels more expensive. That would reduce emissions and generate revenue.
We could raise money with a carbon tax and put that towards education or technology R&D or infrastructure investments or any number of investments that would make our economy stronger and make people better off.
But try getting a new tax through Congress. Previous attempts have gone nowhere, including one last June. Davis thinks we should keep trying, but he admits that the carbon tax has an image problem.
Yeah, who was the idiot who decided to call this a carbon tax? That was the first mistake.
He says the concept needs a new name, such as carbon fee.
And boy, we've got a lot of good people who do marketing. Get some of them working on how to pitch this to a general audience. This is much more important than selling toilet paper.
Much more important, perhaps, but also much more difficult, according to Lena Moffitt of the Sierra Club's Dirty Fuels campaign. The Sierra Club is another leading organization in the climate change movement, and like 350.org, they support a carbon tax. But Moffitt says the choice is not smart legislation or a mass protest. She thinks we need both.
If we're not out there making a whole lot of noise and demanding this action and saying that we're willing to disrupt our daily lives, get out in the streets, get arrested, and do something pretty dramatic, the other side is definitely going to win.
For Inside Energy, I'm Amy Martin.
Amidst all the politics around climate change, wildlife is feeling its effects. In 2016, a federal court in Montana sided with wildlife advocates, saying the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service needs to do more to protect wolverines from climate change. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards took a snowmobile ride into Wyoming's wolverine country to find out how the species is doing there.
The snow turns to mush in the warm sun under our snowmobile tread. I'm tagging along with Wyoming Game and Fish wolverine biologist Lee Taffelmeyer into the south end of the Wind River Range to take down a motion-censored camera he's been baiting with roadkill deer in an effort to take photos of wolverines. It's all part of a multi-state project to count this elusive species in the West. Last year, they took 53 photos of an estimated 5 animals. After the snowmobile ride, we plan to ski several miles, too.
It's just the nature of wolverine research is that it's going to be hard.
That's because wolverines live in the highest mountains and are very rare. Lee says trapping in the 19th century nearly wiped them out. Researchers think there's only around 300 in the lower 48 and only those 5 in Wyoming. But Taffelmeyer says as the largest animal in the weasel family, they're not shy.
A lot of people would just call them like badasses, really. That's a one-word description of a wolverine.
He says one radio-collared male was tracked from Yellowstone and oil field workers reported seeing him crossing the Red Desert. Then he turned up in Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado, almost 500 miles away.
I mean, this is an animal that's 2 feet off the ground, weighs 25, 40 pounds, and it just goes. You know, it'll go anywhere. You know, it'll cross the Tetons in a day, you know, across from Jenny Lake over to the west side.
Anywhere in search of food. Its Latin name is Gulo Gulo, gluttonous glutton. It hunts down snowshoe hares, marmots, squirrels.
They've been known to take down animals as big as a moose before, but that's rare.
In winter, though, they're alpine scavengers.
There's a story that a wolverine dug down through 20 feet of avalanche debris to find a dead mountain goat. So that's 20 feet of concrete
we just dug through.
That wolverine smelled it through that and dug straight down to that carcass. So we'll go up and to the right.
Okay.
Today, we learned something about how hard snow digging can be. On our way to collect photos, the snowmobiles get stuck in the fast-melting snow. Really stuck. And we decide to turn back. But for wolverines, there's no escaping this wet snow. Right now, females are raising young in snow dens. The Wolverine Foundation director, Rebecca Waters.
When the snow is really wet and heavy and the water starts to drop out of the snowpack, it's a problem because then the kits get wet inside the den and that's potentially, you know, a problem for disease and becoming ill and getting cold.
Her group isn't one of those challenging the federal decision to list wolverines, but she says she's glad the court sent them back to the drawing board. Waters says with their crampon-like claws and snowshoe-shaped feet, wolverines are an ice age animal that persisted into a warming era.
You know, the problem with climate change as a threat to a species like the wolverine is the fact that this is a systemic threat. It's at a society-wide and global level. And so I think we need to assess what the states are doing and look at how that turns out.
By states, she means Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, and Washington, working together on a federal grant to count wolverines and study their range. She says states were able to adopt strict regulations to keep sage-grouse from getting listed, so maybe they can do the same for wolverines. Nicole Bjornley with Wyoming Game and Fish says Wyoming hopes to do just that.
We classify wolverines as a species of greatest conservation need in the state, as well as a protected animal by statute. And so Game and Fish has long recognized that this is a potentially sensitive species, one that we just haven't had the opportunity to really devote some funds and personnel to up until now.
To get a better count of wolverines, she says next year they plan to set up 25 more cameras in the Bighorn Range and the national parks. She says there's even talk of relocating wolverine into the state from Alaska, where there are larger populations. As to the camera I snowmobiled out to see with Lee Taffelmeyer, he gives me a call after he pulls it down a few days later. While he didn't get any photos of wolverines this time...
And then looks like we have a red fox. Oh, we've got a little squirrel here.
No wolverines this time.
No wolverines this time. No, that's too bad.
The elusive wolverine slips away again.
And it's not just animals that are experiencing the effects of climate change. Since 2014, a few hardy souls at Central Wyoming College in Riverton have been making an expedition up to the Dinwiddie Glacier in the Wind River Range to document how climate change is taking its toll on one of the state's largest glaciers. Melody Edwards made the trek with them at the end of summer in 2016.
It's a hard 23-mile hike into the Dinwiddie Glacier, and every step is a study in the powerful impact glaciers have had on these mountains in the last 1.5 million years.
This particular valley is actually really cool because you can see essentially vertical cliffs all the way down. There's no question where the glacier went and how it scoured out the sides of the mountain.
That's our guide, University of Wyoming hydrologist Elizabeth Traver. This is her second year partnering with the Interdisciplinary Climate Change Expedition, or ICE. Her job? To teach students how to measure just how much water is melting off the glacier. And it's melting fast. In the last 50 years, about 34% of Dinwiddie Glacier has washed away. Under a hot afternoon sun, all that glacial melt really rages, making creek crossings with heavy packs downright dangerous.
If we want to do this truly safely, one person on this side should take off a pack. So if someone falls in, you have a pack off, you can catch them.
Day three, we round a corner, and there's Dinwiddie, a glacially slow-moving river of ice.
And if you look at it, you can actually see like a current in it.
It flows off the flank of Wyoming's highest mountain, Gannett Peak. Wyoming has the largest concentration of glaciers in the Rocky Mountains, 38 of them, and 25 are in the Wind Rivers. As it flows down, the glacier heaves up giant boulders as it bulldozed. Tucked among these boulders, we find a makeshift glacier research station, where 13 students and 3 professors are hard at work on several scientific studies to track the glacier's retreat.
Unquestionably, this area is changing, and it's changing with haste.
That's their leader, CWC environmental health instructor Jackie Clancher. Wiry and energetic, she's passionate about this glacier. She gestures wildly up at the splashes of black dirt and rock fallen onto the glacier's fringe.
This long finger is new to us this year. That dirt stream there is new to us, and that is new to us.
She says as the ice melts, debris above falls off, and all that dirt speeds up melting because its dark color attracts heat.
It's on its way to becoming essentially a rock glacier. Any layperson could come up here 3 years in a row and be stunned each year by the dramatic transformation.
But it's not just all that dirt that's heating it up.
All right, Jackie.
Climbing.
One of Clancher's former students, geography major Lane Tommy, takes me down into the glacier's moat. It's sort of like a castle's, but...
basically a glacier that is connected to a rock. And since this rock is so hot, it just melts away, you know, this separate area. And it creates this ditch-like area.
A ditch about 3 stories deep, and right now, we're at the bottom of it. Today, Tommy is ice climbing up the wall of the moat to collect snow samples. He's looking for black carbon, microscopic flecks of exhaust from cars and factories that drift here from around the world. He says on a day like this, when the sun shines on the glacier...
those little black specks heat up and accelerate the melting process of the glacier. And that's why it's really important to figure out, you know, where all this is coming from.
And that's exactly what he's hoping these samples will tell him. After he's done, we slip and slide off the glacier to its toe. Here, melted ice filled with fine ground rock called glacial flour turns the water a milky turquoise. The creek is narrow here, a good spot for hydrology students to get a reading of just how much water is melting off the glacier.
We want to have a benchmark so we can use this in the next years as climate change increases the temperatures and increases the melting of the glaciers.
That's CWC outdoor education sophomore Grace Hartman. She takes notes while another student stands in rubber waders in the middle of the icy creek with a flow meter.
So it's a metal rod and has a sensor on the end where it can measure the velocity of the water.
Hartman says the Dinwiddie Glacier provides a steady, predictable source of water for ranchers in the Wind River Valley below, including the reservation. In a way, it's a frozen reservoir, supplying them with water for crops and livestock year-round. But right now, that frozen reservoir is deflating like a balloon, and the ICE project found a way to track that loss of volume. Using pack horses, they actually hauled a 60-pound piece of equipment called a ground-penetrating radar up here. This GPR can measure the thickness of the ice by locating exactly where the bedrock is underneath. University of North Dakota student Lance D'Angeli is doing his thesis on the glacier.
Now we have length, height, and width, so that way we can get the total volume of the glacier and see how that's really changed.
In Wyoming, people have started to worry that climate will someday deplete the amount of water that goes to irrigators downstream. But ICE project leader Jackie Clancher says it goes way beyond Wyoming. She says, sitting on the Continental Divide, Dinwiddie Glacier is the headwaters of the Missouri River.
This is not Fremont County's water. This is not the Wind River Indian Reservation's water. This is not Wyoming water. This is the nation's water because it flows into the Missouri Water Resource Region.
I think of that as I scoop up a water bottle full of melting glacier and drink deep. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. You can catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. In the meantime, you can find more stories about The Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Caitlin Tan produced the show. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell. And I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.